WUSB Stony Brook, 90.1 FM and W297 BM Stony Brook, 107.3 FM.
From New York, this is Democracy Now!
Too many of our people are worshiping a false idol once again. They are enraptured by it, they are drunk on it, they are profaned by it. And that false idol is called Zionism.
Leader in the Streets, award-winning author and activist Naomi Klein joins thousands at Grand Army Plaza in Brooklyn on the second night of Passover, one block from Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer's home. As many as 300 people were arrested. Then, months ago, a State Department panel urged the Biden administration to disqualify multiple Israeli military and police units from receiving U.S. aid over serious human rights abuses. But Secretary of State Blinken has still not taken action. We'll speak with the ProPublica reporter who broke the story. Then, as we broadcast, climate activists gather at the global headquarters of Citigroup here in Manhattan to demand the bank stop financing coal, oil, and gas companies.
We are calling for Citibank to commit to end funding and financing services for new and expanding liquefied methane gas projects and their parent companies, including all projects that have already been built and those that have not been built.
We'll speak with environmentalist Rachetto Zanna of Sulphur, Louisiana. And high-level migration talks between the U.S. and Cuba are held in Washington. We'll talk with Cuba's deputy foreign minister.
The aim of the United States policy since 1960 has been to make life as difficult and as unbearable as possible for the people of Cuba, with the ambition that that would lead to the overthrow of the government. That is the impact for the people of Cuba.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The U.S. Senate has approved a $95 billion foreign and military aid package to help Ukraine, Israel, and Taiwan. The bill also included a provision that could lead to a ban on TikTok. This is Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer.
Mr. President, today, the Senate sends a unified message to the entire world. America will always defend democracy in its hour of need. We tell our allies, we will stand with you. We tell our adversaries, don't mess with us. We tell the world, we will do everything to defend democracy and our way of life.
The final vote in the Senate was 79 to 18. Senators voting no included 15 Republicans, as well as Democratic Senators Jeff Merkley and Peter Welch, and Independent Senator Bernie Sanders.
We are now in the absurd situation where Israel is using U.S. military assistance to block the delivery of U.S. humanitarian aid to Palestinians. If that is not crazy, I don't know what is, but it's also a clear violation of U.S. law. Given that reality, we should not today even be having this debate. It is illegal to continue current military aid to Israel, let alone send another $9 billion with no strings attached.
The Senate approved sending more money to Israel on the same day. United Nations called for an independent probe into the discovery of over 300 bodies in a mass grave at the Nasser Medical Complex following Israel's siege on the hospital. Ravina Shamdasani is a spokesperson for the UN Office of the High Commissioner for Human Rights.
We are horrified also by the destruction of Al-Nasser Medical Complex and Al-Shifa Medical Complex, and the reports of the discovery of mass graves in and around facilities. And we call for independent, effective, transparent investigations into the deaths. Given the prevailing climate of impunity, this should include international investigators. Hospitals are entitled to very special protection under international humanitarian law. And let's be clear, the intentional killing of civilians, detainees, and others who are hors de combat is a war crime.
On Tuesday, U.S. State Department spokesperson Vedant Patel refused to support the U.N. call for a probe into the mass graves in Gaza. Patel was questioned by journalist Saeed Arika.
More than 300 bodies have been found. The United Nations is asking or calling for an independent investigation. Would you support such an independent investigation?
Right now, Saeed, we are asking for more information.
Right.
That is squarely where we're leaving the conversation. Right. I don't have any details to match, confirm, or offer as it relates to that. We're aware of those reports, and we have asked the government of Israel for additional clarity and information, and that's where I'm at.
In Brooklyn, New York, police arrested as many as 300 Jewish activists who took part in a massive outdoor Passover Seder near the home of Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer. Protesters were calling for the U.S. to stop funding Israel's assault on Gaza. This is Simone Zimmerman of Jewish Voice for Peace.
What does it mean to celebrate a holiday about liberation in a moment in which Palestinian lives and freedom are under their most grave assault since the Nakba of 1948.
Simone Zimmerman was addressing a Seder in the streets. This comes as campus protests continue to spread. At the University of Minnesota, police arrested 9 students who refused to take down a pro-Palestinian encampment. In California, the campus of Cal Poly Humboldt was shut down after students occupied a building. In Massachusetts, officials at Harvard University have closed Harvard Yard ahead of possible protests. Harvard has also suspended the student group Palestine Solidarity Committee. Meanwhile, here in New York, NYU has put up a plywood wall around Gould Plaza, where police arrested students on Monday. And students at Columbia University have reportedly been given a deadline to shut down their Gaza Solidarity encampment by this morning. Suspended Barnard College student Sof Eskenazi spoke on Tuesday.
I cannot and could not stand to be complicit in our university's ongoing support for Israel's genocidal campaign. There are no universities left in Gaza, so we chose to reclaim our university for the people of Palestine.
At Donald Trump's criminal trial in Lower Manhattan, the former publisher of the National Enquirer, David Pecker, had told jurors that he helped Trump's 2016 campaign by killing stories about Trump's extramarital affairs while running fake stories about Trump's opponents. Pecker testified he began helping Trump after a meeting at Trump Tower in 2015 where the future president asked him to, quote, help the campaign, unquote. Pecker went on to describe the paper's so-called catch-and-kill policy that involved buying, then burying negative articles about Trump. Pecker said, quote, I said I would be your eyes and ears, unquote. Pecker also admitted the National Enquirer made up a story attacking Trump's rival Ted Cruz by falsely linking his Cuban-born father to Lee Harvey Oswald and the Kennedy assassination. Meanwhile, the judge presiding over Trump's trial, Juan Merchan, is expected to rule soon on whether to hold Trump in contempt of court for attacking witnesses and jurors. On Tuesday, the judge lashed out at Trump's lawyer, saying, quote, you're losing all credibility with the court. In other legal news, the U.S. Supreme Court hears arguments today on Idaho's near-total abortion ban. The Biden administration sued Idaho, saying the ban violates EMTALA, the Emergency Medical Treatment and Active Labor Act, which the Justice Department says protects the rights of pregnant people to get the emergency medical care they need. In Pennsylvania, Democratic Congressmember Summer Lee has defeated Bhavini Patel. Lee was one of the first members of Congress to call for a ceasefire in Gaza. On Tuesday night, Lee wrote on social media, quote, opposing genocide is good politics and good policy. Hashtag ceasefire now. Her opponent had been backed by billionaire Republican megadonor Jeffrey Yass, who's an ally of Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. Summer Lee spoke to supporters last night in Pittsburgh.
Our movement is stronger than every GOP billionaire.
Stronger than the people in power.
She She won in Pennsylvania's primary. Secretary of State Tony Blinken is arriving in China today for 3 days of talks in Beijing. On Tuesday, China accused the United States of, quote, stoking military confrontation, unquote, by deploying new powerful missile launchers in the Philippines as part of an ongoing military exercise involving nearly 17,000 U.S. and Filipino troops. In Argentina, hundreds of thousands of people took to the streets Tuesday to protest President Javier Milei's plan to cut spending on higher public education. As many as 500,000 rallied in Buenos Aires alone in what may have been the largest day of action since Milei's election. Voting is continuing in India's massive nationwide elections. Opponents of Prime Minister Narendra Modi have accused him of using hate speech after he described Muslims in India as, quote, infiltrators. The opposition Congress Party has filed a formal complaint against Modi with election authorities. In labor news, the Federal Trade Commission has voted to ban most employers from using non-compete clauses to bar workers from taking jobs at rival companies. The FTC estimates the rule change could boost the earnings of workers by at least $400 billion over the next decade. Republican lawmakers in Tennessee have passed a bill to allow teachers to carry concealed guns on the grounds of public schools. Protesters inside the Tennessee House began chanting, "Blood on your hands," after the Republican leadership cut off debate ahead of the vote. The U.S. Justice Department has agreed to pay nearly $139 million to more than 100 gymnasts who accuse the FBI of grossly mishandling sexual abuse claims against Larry Nassar, the former doctor for Team USA Gymnastics. The FBI's neglect led to Nassar abusing or assaulting over 100 young gymnasts. Between the time the FBI first heard of the accusations in 2015 until Nassar's arrest the following year. He's currently serving a 60-year sentence. And Mumia Abu-Jamal turns 70 today. The imprisoned journalist and former Black Panther has been jailed for over 42 years. Supporters of Mumia Abu-Jamal are planning to rally near Philadelphia City Hall today, where they plan to deliver petitions collected in France calling for his release. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman in New York with Democracy Now! Co-host Juan Gonzalez in Chicago. Hi, Juan.
Hi, Amy, and welcome to all of our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world.
As many as 300 protesters were arrested in Brooklyn on Tuesday night, where thousands of mostly Jewish New Yorkers gathered for a Seder in the streets to stop arming Israel, they said. This on the second night of Passover. The demonstration was held at Grand Army Plaza, one block away from the home of Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer. It came just hours before the Senate overwhelmingly approved a $95 billion foreign aid package that includes some $14 billion in arms and security funding to Israel. A series of speakers addressed the rally, including journalist and author Naomi Klein, Palestinian activist Linda Sarsour, and several Jewish students suspended from Columbia University, where students have held a Gaza solidarity encampment. These are some of the voices of the demonstrators yesterday speaking at the Seder in the streets.
Tonight's Seder in the streets, which will be happening on the second night of Passover, which is a holiday we observe every year that is all about liberation and how our liberations are intertwined with one another, is coming just hours ahead of a likely Senate vote on $14 billion in military funding and weapons to Israel. So we're here to tell Senator Schumer that this is enough and we need to end U.S. complicity in Israel's genocide against Palestinians. And at the core of the Passover story is that we cannot be free until all people are free. And right now, what we're seeing is that the Israeli government and the United States government are carrying out a genocide of Palestinians in Gaza, over 34,000 people killed in 6 months, in the name of Jewish safety, in the false name of Jewish freedom. Jews
get arrested alongside Jewish elders saying, not in our name, as we have been for 6 months. And the Senate is still about to pass this massive funding package.
Happy Passover, free Palestine.
People are taking a rest, saying business as usual, not go on. We are here at the doorstep of Senator Chuck Schumer. To the people in Palestine, we love you. We are with you. We are going to stop this U.S. funding so that you can fight for your own liberation.
If you do not move, you will be arrested.
Some of the voices at the Seder in the streets to stop arming Israel that was held at Grand Army Plaza on Tuesday on the second night of Passover. Among those who addressed the crowd during the Seder was award-winning author and activist Naomi Klein. This is some of what she had to say.
My friends, I've been thinking about Moses and his rage when he came down from the mount to find the Israelites worshiping a golden calf. The eco-feminist in me has always been uneasy about this story. What kind of God is jealous of animals? What kind of God wants to hoard all the sacredness of the earth for himself? But there is, of course, a less literal way of understanding this story. It is a lesson about false idols, about the human tendency to worship the profane and shiny, to look to the small and material rather than the large and transcendent. What I want to say to you this evening at this revolutionary and historic Seder in the streets is that too many of our people are worshiping a false idol once again. They are enraptured by it. They are drunk on it. They are profaned by it. And that false idol is called Zionism. Yes! It is a false idol that takes our most profound biblical stories of justice and emancipation from slavery, the story of Passover itself, and turns them into brutalist weapons of colonial land theft, roadmaps for ethnic cleansing and genocide. It is a false idol that has taken the transcendent idea of the promised land, a metaphor for human liberation that has traveled across faiths to every corner of this globe, and dared to turn it into a deed of sale for a militarist ethnostate. Political Zionism's version of liberation is itself profane. From the start, it required the mass expulsion of Palestinians from their homes and ancestral lands in the Nakba. From the start, it has been at war with collective dreams of liberation. At a Seder, it is worth remembering that this includes the dreams of liberation and self-determination of the Egyptian people. This false idol of Zionism has long equated Israeli safety with Egyptian dictatorship and unfreedom and client state. From the start, it has produced an ugly kind of freedom that saw Palestinian children not as human beings, but as demographic threats. Much as the Pharaoh in the book of Exodus feared the growing population of Israelites and thus ordered the death of their sons. And as we know, Moses was saved from that by being put in a basket and adopted by an Egyptian woman. Zionism has brought us to our present moment of cataclysm, and it is time that we say clearly, it has always been leading us here. It is a false idol that has led far too many of our own people down a deeply immoral path that now has them justifying the shredding of core commandments. Thou shalt not kill. Thou shalt not steal. Thou shalt not covet. The commandments brought down from the mount. It is a false idol that equates Jewish freedom with cluster bombs that kill and maim Palestinian children. Zionism is a false idol that has betrayed every Jewish value, including the value that we place on questioning, a practice embedded in the Seder itself with its four questions asked by the youngest child. It also betrays the love that we have as a people for text and for education. Today, this false idol dares to justify the bombing of every single university in Gaza, the destruction of countless schools, of archives, of printing presses, the killing of hundreds of academics, scholars, journalists, poets, essayists. This is what Palestinians call scholasticide, the killing of the infrastructure and the means of education. Meanwhile, in this city, the universities call the NYPD and barricade themselves against the grave threat posed by their own students, asking them, students embodying the spirit of the Seder, asking the most basic question, asking questions like, how can you claim to believe in anything at all, least of all us, while you enable, invest in, and collaborate with this genocide? The false idol of Zionism has been allowed to grow unchecked for far too long. So tonight we say, it ends here. Judaism cannot be contained by an ethnostate, for our Judaism is internationalist by its very nature. Our Judaism cannot be protected by the rampaging military of that ethnostate, for all that military does is sow sorrow and reap hatred, including hatred against us as Jews. Our Judaism is not threatened by people raising their voices in solidarity with Palestine across lines of race, ethnicity, physical ability, gender identity, and generations. Our Judaism is one of those voices and knows that in this chorus lies both our safety and our collective liberation. Judaism is the Passover, is the Judaism of the Passover Seder, the gathering in ceremony to share food and wine with loved ones and strangers alike. This ritual, light enough to carry on our backs, in need of nothing but one another, we don't need walls, we need no temple, no rabbi, and there is a role for everyone, including, especially, the smallest child. The Seder is portable, a diaspora technology, if ever there was one. It is made to hold our collective grieving, our contemplation, our questioning, our remembering, and our reviving and rekindling of the revolutionary spirit. So tonight, look around. This here is our Judaism. As waters rise and forests burn and nothing is certain, we pray at the altar of solidarity and mutual aid, no matter the cost. We don't need or want the false idol of Zionism. We want freedom from the project that commits genocide in our name. We want freedom from the ideology that has no plan for peace except for deals with murderous theocratic petrostates next door while selling the technologies of robo-assassinations to the world. We seek to liberate Judaism from an ethnostate that wants Jews to be perennially afraid, that wants our children afraid, that wants us to believe that the world is against us so that we go running to its fortress, or at least keep sending the weapons and the donations. That is a false idol. And it's not just Netanyahu. It's the world he made and the world that made him. It's Zionism.
That's right.
What are we? We, in these streets for months and months, we are the Exodus from Zionism. Yes. So, to the Chuck Schumers of this world, we do not say, let our people go. We say, we have already gone, and your kids, they're with us now.
Award-winning journalist and author Naomi Klein, speaking at what was called the Seder in the Streets to Stop Arming Israel on Tuesday at Grand Army Plaza in Brooklyn, a block from Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer's home. Special thanks to Hannah Elias, Eric Halverson, and Ishmael Darrow of Democracy Now! This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Months ago, a State Department panel urged the Biden administration to disqualify multiple Israeli military and police units from receiving U.S. aid over serious human rights abuses, including rape and torture. That's according to an article in ProPublica, which reports that Secretary of State Blinken received the recommendation in December, but has still not taken any action. We're joined now by Brett Murphy, reporter for ProPublica, where his latest pieces are Netanyahu resists U.S. plan to cut off aid to Israeli military unit, and Blinken is sitting on staff recommendations to sanction Israeli military units linked to killings or rapes. Brett, welcome back to Democracy Now! So this latest piece, lay out what is this State Department panel that made this recommendation, and talk about what Blinken has done since.
Yeah, it's a very special panel. It's unique to Israel. Other countries do not have this sort of consideration. And what it's supposed to do is review allegations of a gross human rights violation. That could be an extrajudicial killing, that could be a rape. And they look at public reports, and then they see if the Israeli government has held the individual perpetrators accountable. If they haven't, held them accountable, then they're supposed to make a recommendation to either stop giving aid to that specific unit or to continue allowing aid to go to that unit. This has never happened in the history of Israel. Almost every other country where we give foreign assistance to, they have units who are disqualified from that type of aid, but not Israel. Finally, this happened in December. For the first time ever, recommendations went up to Blinken to sanction specific units inside of the Israeli military. But for months now, he has not done anything with those recommendations.
And Brett, could you talk about one of those units, Netzah Yehuda, the country's all-male, ultra-Orthodox battalion?
Yeah, so there's been some reporting over the weekend that one of the units that went to Blinken was Netzah Yehuda. This is an ultra-Orthodox all-male battalion. It had been operating largely in the West Bank for years. It was founded around 1999, and for years it's been accused of human rights abuses, shooting civilians, beating civilians, so much so that a few years ago it was actually removed by the government of Israel from the West Bank and relocated to the Golan Heights.
And also, could you, for those who are not familiar with the Leahy Amendment, the 1997 law that requires the United States to cut off financial aid to or military aid to units that are credibly accused of human rights violations?
Sure. So the Leahy law was developed specifically to address specific units inside of any foreign government. There are other laws on the books that are much broader, much more general, but they've never been implemented in a systematic way. So the Leahy law wanted to address that. Senator Leahy and others thought if the State Department could identify specific units inside of these governments and then disqualify them from receiving aid, then that would have, you know, more of a salutary effect than they had been seeing with previous laws. Like I was saying before, most other countries have to apply for aid on a unit by unit basis. So they will first ask the State Department if they can use American financing for equipment, arms, training, that sort of thing. And then the State Department will review that unit, see if they're on the no-fly list, if they've been disqualified. But for Israel, Egypt, it's different. They receive so much aid, so much financing that the State Department has been largely blind to what specific units are using that aid. That's why they came up with this forum, this amendment in 2019. This forum was meant to kind of look back and address specifically which units should be disqualified, and then we would give that list over to the governments of Israel and Egypt.
And finally, just to be clear, Brett, we've heard in the last days that Biden is cutting off aid to the ultra-Orthodox unit. Talk about, was there a meeting between Blinken and Benny Gantz? Is this aid being cut off?
So he's been asked, Secretary Blinken has been asked several times, as well as his spokespersons, what's the status of those cases. And he has so far punted. And we know over the weekend, Prime Minister Netanyahu, Benny Gantz, they have been publicly and fiercely lobbying against any proposed sanctions. Benny Gantz said he called Blinken personally and they talked about it. They want him to reverse course.
Well, I want to thank you so much for being with us. Brett Murphy, reporter for ProPublica, where his latest pieces are Netanyahu resists U.S. plan to cut off aid to Israeli military unit and Blinken sitting on staff recommendations to sanction Israeli military units linked to killings or rapes. Coming up, climate activists are gathering at the global headquarters of Citigroup as we broadcast here in New York to demand the bank stop financing coal, oil, and gas. Stay with us.
Racism, turn me around, turn me around, turn me around, ain't gonna let racism turn me around. I'm gonna keep on walking, keep on talking, marching up to freedom land.
I ain't gonna let no APAC
turn me around.
Performance by the Resistance Revival Chorus at the Jewish Voice for Peace Seder in Brooklyn. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Climate activists are gathering at the global headquarters of Citigroup here in Manhattan to demand the bank stop financing coal, oil, and gas companies. The protests come on the heels of a first-of-its-kind Earth Day hearing where environmental activists from around the world gathered in New York this week to condemn Citigroup's environmental, what they call environmental racism. Citibank is the world's second-largest funder of coal, oil, and gas. We're joined here in our New York studio by Rashedo Zan, a Black environmental leader from Sulphur, Louisiana, who's been leading the fight against the Citibank-funded LNG build-out in her community. She's the founder and director of the Environmental Justice Group, the Vessel Project. Thank you so much for being with us. Welcome back to Democracy Now!, Rashedo. We're in a moment going to try to go right to that Citigroup protest in the streets, but can you explain what this gathering is about and what you're demanding of Citigroup?
Yes, thank you so much for having me. It is simple. Citigroup is the second largest financial institution that is backing liquefied natural gas projects along the Louisiana and Texas Gulf Coast. And so we are here demanding that Citibank stops its financing of these projects.
And can you talk about the health issues that your own family and community have been experiencing because of the liquefied natural gas facilities in your area?
Yes, we have three of the current operating liquefied natural gas projects in our community. These projects emit things like methane and other chemical pollutions. Those long-term exposure to those type of chemical releases causes things like asthma, eczema, and cancer, things of which my children are suffering with. Two of my children have asthma. Some of them have eczema. My own sister is currently in remission from cancer. My son has recently been diagnosed with epilepsy. And upon traveling to a doctor out of state, we learned that the industrial pollution is causing him to have more seizures. So I'm fighting not only for myself and my community, but for my children. And by fighting for my children, I'm fighting for everyone's children.
Rashida, we're going to go to the streets of New York now, where Alice Hu from New York Communities for Change, one of the leading organizers, is joining us from Citigroup headquarters, main entrance. Alice, can you describe the scene there? Who's out there and what you're planning to do?
Hundreds of protesters are out there today, blocking every single entrance of Citigroup's global headquarters right now. We've stopped employees from getting in the front door. We've stopped employees from getting to the side doors and the back doors. The reason we're doing that is because Citibank is the world's second largest funder of fossil fuels. We tried to create discussions before. We tried to create talks, sharing our stories, sharing how frontline communities are being killed by fossil fuel projects. They have not listened, which is why we're shorting the mass, sustained violence in the media to have them respond to our demands.
And Alice, what is Citibank's response?
In the past, when we've, you know, done other protests like this, when we have sent petitions, when we've gotten representatives from leaders, from community organizations, they always say, we care about the planet, we care about your communities, we're listening, but actions speak louder than words. Citibank has poured over $332 billion into fossil fuels since the Paris agreements were signed in 2016. They have not listened to us. They are not responding to our demands. And that is why we are taking the next step. We are going to sustain nonviolent civil disobedience and pressure until they listen, until they respect communities, until they stop killing us.
I wanted to ask you, in January, the Biden administration announced a pause in reviewing applications for LNG facilities. How does this pause look on the ground right now?
I think that it was a good first step. The pause needs to be made permanent. And in fact, all fossil fuel expansion worldwide needs to stop. I think that Citibank needs to be taking cues from the climate movement, from the people on the ground who have successfully pressured Biden to make that pause happen. Citigroup needs to take the next step as well. Stop financing fossil fuels. Stop financing LNG expansion.
I want to go back to Rashida for a moment. What do you make of the United Nations warning to Citibank regarding human rights violations related to fossil fuel expansion, Rashida?
Citibank continues to violate indigenous rights, human rights, when they continue to fund these projects. And so that's why we're here. We are demanding that Citibank follow suit, follow President Biden's start with pausing the reviewing of these applications and stop the funding. Because what we've learned is that if these projects are permitted, if they get the permits that they need, if they don't have the funding or the insurance, they cannot move forward. And so by constantly providing that money for these projects to be built, Citi is saying that they don't care about this pause. They're saying that, you know, they don't care about what the UN is warning them. They're going to continue to operate in the same way they've been operating. And that is with no care for any human being or human life, or with disregard for this this planet that we all share.
And Rashida, your offices in Lake Charles were severely damaged on April 10th by a tornado. Can you talk about what was lost and the fundraising that you're involved in to rebuild the Vessel Project's office?
Yes, of course. So where I live in Southwest Louisiana, we are prone to these natural disasters. But what we've been seeing in the last several years are climate-induced disasters because of the methane emissions coming from these LNG terminals that are in our community. Just a couple of weeks ago, Southwest Louisiana was hit by several tornadoes, one of which completely destroyed my vessel project office. It is a resource center. It is where we educate and empower our community to fight back against these things that are constantly coming in, harming and killing us. We had begun collecting items to pass out to the community because hurricane season starts June 1st. This is not even hurricane season, and we're already seeing torrential downpours. We're already seeing, tornadoes that are coming at rates we've never seen before. What is this hurricane season going to look like for us this year? We were trying to prepare the community, and we lost all of those things. So someone knows of the work that I've been doing and knew the things that we have been collecting in our office, and they decided to start a GoFundMe for the organization so that we can rebuild and continue to be that resource for the community.
Rashida Azan, I want to thank you so much for being with us, founder and director of the environmental justice group, The Vessel Project. And thanks to Alice Hu of New York Communities for Change, one of the leading organizers of today's action to shut down Citigroup in New York. When we come back, high-level migration talks between the U.S. and Cuba are being held in Washington. We'll speak with Cuba's deputy foreign minister. Stay with us. Transitions in Blue by Deramir Gonzalez and Pedrito Martinez, both Cuban musicians. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. High-level migration talks between the U.S. and Cuba were held in Washington last week. The twice-annual meetings were suspended during the Trump presidency, but resumed in 2022 by the Biden administration. The U.S. restarted deportation flights to Cuba last year after a two-year pause. Since then, the U.S. has been sending one flight with Cuban deportees to Havana each month. Cuba's long blamed U.S. sanctions for strangling the Cuban economy and the 1966 Cuban Adjustment Act, which grants special entry rights to Cubans and support upon arrival for encouraging its youth to emigrate. We're joined now in our New York studio, not far from the United Nations, by Cuba's Deputy Foreign Minister, Carlos Fernandez de Cossío. Welcome back to Democracy Now! It's great to have you with us. If you can start off by talking about what happened in those talks last week.
Well, thank you for having me. Last week, we had one of the regular sessions that we have as part of the implementation of the several agreements in migration that exist between Cuba and the United States. The aim of those agreements is to secure a safe, regular, and orderly migration between the two countries. And they have several issues that have to be implemented for that. But there's a given reality that is difficult to disconnect, which is the economic conditions of the people of Cuba push them to migrate. An important factor in provoking those conditions are U.S. deliberate policies of destroying the Cuban economy and make it unworkable. Therefore, we insist and we put a lot of emphasis in saying that there will continue to be a potential of Cuban migrants wanting to reach the borders of the United States as long as this policy continues to push people out of the country. And as long as the United States has a inviting policy for Cubans, which are enjoy privilege when they try to enter irregularly in the United States.
And Foreign Minister, I wanted to ask you, the United Nations every year votes to oppose U.S. sanctions against Cuba. I think in the latest vote, only two nations in the entire General Assembly were opposed. That was Israel and the United States. Can you talk about the impact of this continued blockade and sanctions against your country?
The impact is overwhelming. The United States does not have, and no country has, a more comprehensive system of economic coercive measures against any country, nor has it been applied for as long as it has been applied against Cuba, which is over 63, 64 years ago. And if you just look at the asymmetry between the two countries, the size of the U.S. economy and the modest dimensions of the Cuban economy, you can try to understand the impact it has. It is a policy of economic warfare, trying to destroy not only the Cuban economy, but the system of social justice on which depends the well-being of the majority of Cubans.
And I wanted to ask you, in recent years, there's been a greater migration of Cubans from the island to the United States than at any time in U.S. history, even more than in the aftermath of the Cuban Revolution in the 1960s. And also, the migration has shifted from going across the straits, the Florida Straits, into Central America and Mexico to the U.S. border. Could you talk about why that has happened during especially during the Trump and Biden years?
There's a combination of factors. You have the fact that there are more Cubans living in the United States, and therefore there are more family connections, more friendly connections, so people find that is a place where they will find families and groups that they know. Secondly, the United States has a policy that privileges Cubans in a way that it does not privilege the citizens of any other country in the world. Therefore, Cubans believe that if they reach the border of the United States by whichever means, they have a very high possibility of entering. Now, if you add to that the U.S. has a standing policy of deliberately attacking the well-being, the standard, and the living standards of the people of Cuba, attacking the economy, it is logical for there to be a push. Now, Cubans don't see any possibility at the moment of a change in U.S. policy. Increasingly, they see that the United States plans to continue to punish their country, and therefore a group of Cubans, not all Cubans, but a part of our citizens, leave the country. You have the half of Puerto Rico have left the island to come to the United States because of the economic conditions of that island, and yet that island does not suffer a policy of aggression as Cuba does from the government of the United States.
I want to ask you about the continued effects of the embargo against Cuba. And also, in November, the UN General Assembly called for the 31st time on the United States to end that decades-long trade embargo against Cuba. Every country approved the non-binding resolution except the United States and Israel. Oh, and Ukraine abstained from the vote. Your response?
This resolution has been approved for the past 31 years, or 32 years, at the UN. So it's not new. The U.S. has been totally isolated. I believe that there's no other example of consistent isolation by a country in the UN as this one. The other one would be Palestine, perhaps, is the only other subject in which there's such level of isolation. It's a moral message because the UN does not have the capacity to lift U.S. coercive measures against Cuba. But in addition to the resolution, over 34 heads of delegations at the General Assembly last year, at the general debate, specifically requested the U.S. to take Cuba out of a very arbitrary list of the State Department that alleges that Cuba is a country that sponsors terrorism. No official in Washington, I've spoken with many, even takes the trouble explain to me why Cuba should be in that list. And the slander is not the main problem. The problem is that being in that list automatically triggers a set of additional coercive measures that makes Cuba have very serious problems to conduct our trade, our financing in any corner of the world, including countries that have a very friendly relationship with Cuba.
Like what? What are these issues that
banks,
you have to deal
banks with? Would not give us loan. Banks would not participate in trade. So we've had companies with which we've traded for years to supply for our electrical infrastructure, for healthcare, for transportation, that cannot trade with us anymore because the banks that they use are not ready. The banks that they use do not want to challenge the intimidating impact of U.S. policy against Cuba. And they say, look, we have nothing against you, but we don't want to suffer the consequences in the United States.
I wanted to ask you about Cuba's view of what's going on in the presidential race here in the United States. Clearly, under the Obama administration, there was an attempt to normalize relationships between Cuba and the U.S., but neither President Trump nor President Biden have done much to pursue the Obama policies. I'm wondering your sense of the stakes for Cuba in terms of the presidential race in this country and who ends up winning.
I would say that the Trump and the Biden administration have done more. They've not only not done much, but they've done a lot to try to derail the progress between the two nations and that were celebrated by the peoples of both countries to improve our relationship and to work towards a respectful relationship. The impact for Cuba is tremendous. Now, we're not involved in U.S. elections. And what we try or what we wish would happen, what we're hoping for, is that whoever is elected in January would try to take a more reasonable approach toward Cuba, one that is fair, that would lead the government of the United States to do something that is correct, and allow the people of Cuba and the people of the United States to be able to engage with each other without restrictions. In the U.S., any link by Americans with Cuba is prohibited. You need a permission of the government to relate with Cuba, to travel to Cuba, to invest in Cuba. If you travel to Cuba, you need a permission of the government that will tell you where you can stay and where you cannot stay, to play golf, to play baseball. You need a permission from the U.S. government. We wish for there to be a policy that would allow Americans to freely engage with our country, as citizens of any country do, or as Americans can do with any other country.
So let me ask you, what's happened? Because Obama began normalizing relations. Of course, so President Obama's vice president is Vice President Biden. So is he going back on this? And number two, I'm wondering, as you listen to our broadcast, and you don't need to just do that to see what's happening in the streets of the United States around the protests around Gaza, 300 people just arrested in Brooklyn at a Seder, especially Jewish activists who are concerned about the U.S. support of Israel, the Palestinians, Arab Americans, the massive youth concern about Gaza. What your perspective is and the perspective overall of the Global South on this issue?
So two different questions. On the first, we expect the government of the United States, the Biden administration, not to faithfully follow the coercive measures of reinforcement that were put by the Trump administration. And that is what has occurred. We were surprised that we didn't think that there was going to be such loyalty by the Biden administration to the measures that were put in place by the Trump administration. That was surprising for us and, for what I gather, surprising for many Americans. Now, regarding Gaza, our positions are very strong. There have been also very massive, a lot of rallies in Cuba. The difference is that our president and our political leadership has been at the forefront of those rallies, joining them and being a participant with the rest of the people. We have a very strong and critical position against the massacres that are occurring in Palestine today. We see it as a brutal manifestation of what has been happening there for the past 75 years. The killings, the kidnappings, the displacements of the people of Palestine. This is just a very brutal manifestation of a very long history. And Israel can only do that because they have the financial,
historical,
the military, and the political support of the U.S.
I wanted to ask you about some historical matters. Most people are not aware that Ernesto Che Guevara, one of the founders of the July 26th revolutionary movement, visited Gaza in 1959. Do you know why did Che visit Gaza back then, and how did his visit spark global solidarity with the Palestinian struggle?
He visited in solidarity with the people of Palestine. At the time, we still had diplomatic relations with the government of Israel, but we believe that we owed to the people of Palestine our solidarity. You have to remember that in 1947, Cuba, and this is before the revolution, had a very strong position when the State of Israel was created about the dangers that this could have if it was not managed correctly by the UN when they took the decision. So it's not surprising that in the early months of the Cuban Revolution, one of our main leaders, Che Guevara, visited Gaza.
And more recently, I wanted to ask you about the protests that erupted in March after some blackouts, electricity blackouts in Cuba, in the second city of Cuba, Santiago. What has developed since then? And the Cuban government was suggesting that the United States was somehow or other stoking or supporting those protests.
The U.S. government invests millions of dollars every year to try to create an opposition in Cuba, to destabilize the country, to provoke people to act against the government. On March 17th, a group of people in Santiago, as you're saying, came out to the street to protest. The protest because there were blackouts. The protest because of they're demanding food. But the food that they were demanding is not the food that's in the stores, in private stores normally. They were demanding, and rightfully so, the food that is subsidized by the government. Powdered milk, bread, electricity, which is also subsidized in Cuba. Because they are accustomed to a system of social justice that our government provides, and that the U.S. government is trying to destroy. We know as a fact that the U.S. invested in those protests to be larger, to be violent, and to be in many cities. It was a failure for the U.S. government. People protested peacefully, and they have a right to do so.
On a separate issue, Deputy Foreign Minister of Cuba, I wanted to ask you about Cuba's position on Mexico cutting diplomatic ties with Ecuador after Ecuador raided Mexico's embassy in Quito, where the Ecuadorian Vice President Jorge Glass had taken refuge for months. What's Cuba's position?
We respect Mexico's decision. The violation of their embassy is something unprecedented. For some reason, the international community has always respected the immunity of foreign diplomatic missions. Because if not, there cannot be contact, there cannot be official contact between countries. And for some reason, the international community, regardless of the ideological trend, have always respected that. This was a brutal violation of the Vienna Convention, and it established a very dangerous precedent for every country. So we respect Mexico's position.
And finally, I wanted to ask you about something that's been in the media now for several years here in the United States, the so-called Havana syndrome of diplomats from the United States suddenly becoming sickened in Cuba. Could you talk about what you know about this?
The so-called
Havana, 30 seconds.
The so-called Havana syndrome is a fable. It was created to derail the relationship between Cuba and the United States. They needed an excuse. The big question is, who invented this? The media has not gone far enough to say who invented, how was this theory that challenges science, challenges physics, challenges the academic community around the world, how was that invented, and how did the government of the United States decide to incorporate it in its agenda?
In fact, U.S. diplomats say that they're getting sick around the world.
And we don't question the symptoms that people might have. What we question is the explanation that began by Sonic, and then they're saying that it's a concussion without a concussion having occurred. Scientists say that does not